A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one with a warning attached. Do not listen while eating lunch. Someone he knows discovered their 10-month-old had reached into their nappy, pulled out some stool, and was in the process of examining it with their mouth. The parents' first reaction was a gag reflex, and the second was a panicked plea to ChatGPT for instructions. The story ended fine. ChatGPT walked them through a cleaning and sanitization routine, but it raises the bigger question of what the actual health risks are here, and what parents should really do when this happens. Because it will happen. Probably more than once.
It absolutely will. And I want to start by saying something I think gets lost in the panic of the moment. This is developmentally normal. It's not a sign of anything wrong with the child. At 10 months, the primary way infants explore the world is through their mouth. Everything goes in there. The fact that what went in there this time was feces doesn't mean you failed as a parent. It means you have a 10-month-old.
The mouth as primary research instrument.
And it's a remarkably effective one. The tongue has more nerve endings than almost anywhere else on the body. Babies are running a full chemical analysis on everything they can reach. The problem is just that some things in the sample set are biohazards.
Let's get concrete. The parent in this story panicked and asked ChatGPT, "Before we get into what the actual medical guidance says, was that a reasonable response?" Because I can imagine half the listeners thinking, "Why wouldn't you just call your pediatrician?" And the other half thinking, "I would absolutely do the same thing."
I think it was reasonable in the moment. It's 11 at night, you're alone with the baby, you're gagging, you need step-by-step instructions right now. ChatGPT is available. That said, there are things I'd want a parent to know ahead of time so they don't have to ask an AI in a panic. And the core thing to know is that in the vast majority of cases, a single ingestion of a small amount of a child's own stool is not a medical emergency.
That's the headline.
The primary risk is enteric pathogens, bacteria, viruses, parasites that live in the gastrointestinal tract and are shed in stool. But here's the key detail. A child's own stool contains the same organisms already colonizing their own gut. You're not introducing anything new. The stomach is a formidable barrier. It's an acid bath designed to neutralize exactly this kind of thing. For a healthy 10-month-old with a normal immune system, the risk of illness from ingesting their own feces is genuinely low.
The panic is mostly about the disgust, not the danger.
But, and this is where I want to be precise, mostly, is not always. There are specific scenarios where the risk goes up. If the child has a known gastrointestinal infection, rotavirus, norovirus, salmonella, shigella, campylobacter, those pathogens are in the stool in high concentrations, and re-ingesting them can prolong the illness or increase severity. If the child attends daycare and has been exposed to other children's pathogens that they might be shedding asymptomatically, that changes the calculus. And if the stool is from someone else, a sibling, a pet, that's a different risk profile entirely.
The autologous versus heterologous distinction.
Autologous ingestion, your own, is lower risk. Heterologous, someone else's, is where you start worrying about hepatitis A, about parasites like giardia, about organisms your immune system hasn't seen before.
For the specific scenario in the prompt, 10-month-old, own stool, small amount, what does the parent actually need to do?
Step one is exactly what ChatGPT apparently told them, clean the child thoroughly. And I mean thoroughly. The mouth, the hands, under the fingernails, anywhere the stool might have spread during the investigation. Step 2 is to monitor for symptoms over the next 24 to 48 hours. Vomiting, diarrhea, fever, unusual irritability. If any of those appear, call your pediatrician. But step 3 is the one nobody mentions, clean the parent. Because in the panic of cleaning the baby, you've almost certainly contaminated your own hands, your clothing, the changing table, the doorknob you touched on the way to the sink.
The invisible spread.
Which is how norovirus takes down an entire household in 48 hours. One fecal-oral transmission event, and suddenly everyone is taking turns in the bathroom. The baby's fine, but the parents are destroyed.
The real vector isn't the baby's mouth. It's the parents' hands 2 minutes later.
That's the thing most people miss. The baby has already ingested it. That ship has sailed. What you're actually managing is secondary transmission. And that brings us to the second part of the prompt, which I think is the more practically useful question. How do you actually clean this up?
The prompt mentions water wipes and the concern that they don't kill germs, and asks whether hand sanitizer is safe to use on a baby's hands after you've removed the visible stool.
Let's talk about water wipes first. Water wipes are essentially water and a tiny amount of fruit extract or preservative on a cloth. They're designed to be as inert as possible for babies with sensitive skin or eczema. They are excellent at mechanically removing visible soiling. But you're right, they contain no antimicrobial agents. They don't kill bacteria or viruses. They just move them around and hopefully off the skin.
Mechanical removal versus disinfection.
For routine nappy changes, mechanical removal is sufficient. You don't need to sterilize a baby's bottom every time they poo. The skin barrier is intact, and the goal is just to get the stool off. But when stool has been on hands that then went into a mouth, the calculus changes. Now you're dealing with mucous membranes, the oral cavity, and you need a higher level of decontamination for the hands.
Is hand sanitizer safe on infant hands?
The short answer is yes, with caveats. Alcohol-based hand sanitizer, 60 to 70% ethanol or isopropanol, is effective against most enteric pathogens and dries quickly. The concern with infants is twofold. One, they put their hands in their mouth constantly, and you don't want them ingesting hand sanitizer residue. Two, their skin is thinner and more permeable, so absorption is a consideration.
If the alternative is fecal residue in the mouth, you're choosing between two imperfect options.
And the clinical guidance I've seen, and this aligns with what the American Academy of Pediatrics has said on this, is that after you've washed the visible stool off with soap and water, applying a small amount of alcohol-based hand sanitizer and letting it dry completely is acceptable. The key phrase is, after soap and water. Hand sanitizer is not a substitute for mechanical cleaning. It's a finishing step. You wash first, then sanitize, then make sure the hands are fully dry before the baby can mouth them again.
The sequence is, remove visible stool with soap and water, dry, then sanitize, then dry again.
That's the sequence. And I'd add one more thing, for the fingernails. Stool gets packed under fingernails in a way that's hard to clean. A soft nail brush with soap and water is your best tool. Hand sanitizer alone won't penetrate under the nail bed effectively. You need mechanical debridement there.
Mechanical debridement is not a phrase I expected in this episode.
It's the medical term for scrubbing gunk out from under your fingernails. I can dress it up if you want.
No. I appreciate the precision. It elevates the whole discussion.
There's another option worth mentioning, which is chlorhexidine-based hand washes. Chlorhexidine is a broad-spectrum antimicrobial that's used in surgical scrubs. It has residual activity. It keeps working on the skin for hours after application. Some pediatric practices use chlorhexidine wipes for certain situations. But for home use with an infant, it's probably overkill, and you'd want to rinse thoroughly to minimize any residue that could be mouthed.
What about the mouth itself? The prompt focuses on hand cleaning, but the stool was also in the mouth.
This is the part that makes parents queasy, but the guidance is straightforward. You don't need to do anything special to the mouth beyond wiping out any visible material with a damp cloth. You don't use mouthwash on a 10-month-old. You don't use hydrogen peroxide. You don't induce vomiting. Never induce vomiting for stool ingestion. The oral mucosa is resilient. Saliva contains antimicrobial enzymes like lysozyme, and whatever small amount was ingested is already heading into the stomach acid. The body is handling it.
The mouth is self-cleaning in a way the hands are not.
And I want to emphasize the don't induce vomiting point, because that's something a panicked parent might reach for, and it's the wrong move. Vomiting introduces aspiration risk. The child could inhale vomit into their lungs, and it doesn't actually remove the ingested material effectively. It just adds a new hazard.
Let's talk about the skin sensitivity angle, because the prompt specifically mentions children who react to fragrances and can't use standard wipes. Is there a middle ground between water wipes and fragranced antibacterial wipes for a situation like this?
One is plain soap and water with a soft cloth. plain, unscented soap, something like a glycerin-based bar or a fragrance. Free liquid Castile soap is effective at breaking down the lipid components of stool and mechanically removing bacteria. It rinses clean and leaves minimal residue. For a one-off fecal incident on hands, this is probably the best option.
It's in every bathroom.
No special products needed. Another option is hypochlorous acid sprays. Hypochlorous acid is a weak acid that's naturally produced by white blood cells as part of the immune response. It's antimicrobial but extremely gentle. It's used in wound care, in ophthalmology, in neonatal settings. There are brands marketed for baby skin care that use hypochlorous acid at very low concentrations, typically around 0.01 to 0.02%. It kills bacteria and viruses on contact, but doesn't sting or irritate.
I've heard you mention hypochlorous acid before. This is one of your things.
It's underappreciated. It's more effective than alcohol against certain pathogens, it doesn't dry the skin, and it's safe if a small amount ends up in the mouth. The downside is, it's not as widely available as hand sanitizer, and it has a shorter shelf life once opened. But for a household with a baby who has sensitive skin, it's worth having a bottle.
It doesn't smell like anything?
A very faint chlorine smell that dissipates almost immediately. Nothing like bleach, nothing like the fragrances in commercial wipes. It's the olfactory equivalent of tap water.
We've got a hierarchy now. For routine nappy changes, water wipes or a damp cloth, mechanical removal only. For a fecal incident involving hands and mouth, soap and water wash, then either alcohol-based hand sanitizer or hypochlorous acid spray with attention to the fingernails. And for the mouth, wipe out visible material, do nothing else.
That's the protocol, and I want to add a piece of context that might help parents calibrate their anxiety. Children ingest fecal material more often than anyone wants to think about. It happens in daycare settings constantly. A child touches a soiled surface, hands go in the mouth. It happens with shared toys. It happens with bathwater. The reason we don't hear about constant outbreaks of illness from these exposures is that the infectious dose matters. A small amount of stool from a healthy child, ingested once, is unlikely to contain enough pathogenic organisms to overcome the stomach's defenses.
Infectious dose is the concept people are missing.
It's the number of organisms required to establish an infection. For something like Shigella, the infectious dose can be as low as 10 to 100 organisms. That's terrifyingly low. But for many other enteric pathogens, you need thousands or millions. And a healthy stomach at the right pH kills most of them before they reach the intestine. The risk is real, but it's not automatic.
What actually goes wrong when it does go wrong? What are the pathogens you'd actually worry about in a developed country?
In a setting with modern sanitation. And I'm assuming the prompt is describing a household in a developed country with access to clean water. The main concerns would be Giardia, Cryptosporidium, and the common viral causes of gastroenteritis, rotavirus, norovirus, adenovirus. Bacterial pathogens like Salmonella, Campylobacter, and pathogenic E. coli are possible but less likely in a healthy child's stool unless there's an active infection. Parasitic infections like ascariasis or strongyloidiasis are extremely uncommon in developed countries with good sanitation.
The risk profile in suburban Jerusalem or Connecticut is different from what it would be in a setting with different sanitation infrastructure.
In settings where open defecation is common or water treatment is inconsistent, you're also worrying about hepatitis A, hepatitis E, cholera, typhoid. Those are not on the radar for most of our listeners. But I want to mention something that crosses those boundaries, antibiotic-resistant organisms. If the child has recently been on antibiotics, their gut flora may include resistant strains, and those can be more difficult to treat if they cause an infection.
That's a second-order concern, but a real one.
It connects to a broader point about why we should take even a low-risk fecal exposure seriously. It's not just about this one incident, it's about the pattern. Repeated ingestion of fecal material, which can happen in neglected hygiene situations, leads to something called environmental enteric dysfunction. That's a chronic inflammation of the gut that impairs nutrient absorption and can cause stunting. That's not what we're talking about with a single incident, but it's the end of the spectrum we're trying to avoid.
That's the long-term view. Let me pull us back to the immediate moment. You're a parent. You've just watched your child eat their own stool. You've cleaned them up. What do you do with yourself? because the prompt mentions the parent's gag reflex, and I think the psychological aftermath is under-discussed.
That's a fair point. The disgust response is powerful and involuntary. It's designed to protect us from exactly this kind of exposure, and parents often feel guilty about being disgusted by their own child. They think it means they're failing at some unconditional love ideal. It doesn't. It means your disgust reflex is functioning correctly.
The body's way of saying that should not go in a mouth.
The body is correct. So give yourself permission to be grossed out. Step away for a moment after the child is safe and clean. Wash your own hands thoroughly. Singing the happy birthday song twice is the standard duration for effective hand washing, about 20 seconds. Change your clothes if you got anything on them. Open a window if the smell is lingering. These are not frivolous concerns. They're part of restoring a sense of control and cleanliness to the environment.
The ritual aspect matters.
And I'd add that if you're really struggling, if the disgust is so intense that you're having trouble touching your child or doing routine care afterwards, that's worth mentioning to your own doctor. Postpartum anxiety and OCD can manifest specifically around contamination fears. It's treatable, and it's more common than people admit.
That's a good flag. Let's shift to the AI angle, because I think there's something worth examining there. A panicked parent asked ChatGPT for medical guidance in an urgent moment, and according to the prompt, it gave good advice. Is that a fluke, or is this actually a reasonable use case for AI?
I've thought about this a lot, and I think the answer is that it's reasonable in a narrow set of circumstances, but you need to understand what you're getting and what you're not getting. ChatGPT and similar models are not medical devices. They're not FDA approved for diagnostic or treatment guidance. They don't have a doctor-patient relationship with you. They can hallucinate, confidently give you wrong information that sounds plausible.
In this specific case,
the question was essentially, my baby ate poop, what do I do? Which is a high-frequency, low-complexity question with a well-established answer. The model has seen this question, or variants of it, thousands of times in its training data. The correct answer is not controversial, so the model gave good guidance. That's not surprising. The danger would be if the parent had a more unusual presentation. Say, the child had a known medical condition, or was on immunosuppressive medication, or the stool contained blood, and the model missed a critical nuance because it doesn't actually understand the case.
It works for the common case and fails unpredictably at the edges.
Which is the story of AI in medicine generally. It's great at pattern matching common presentations. It's not great at identifying when a case is atypical in a clinically significant way. And the parent in a panic is not in a position to know whether their case is typical or atypical. That's the structural problem.
What should a parent actually do? Have a protocol memorized ahead of time?
That's exactly what I'd recommend. Not for this specific scenario necessarily, but for common childhood incidents generally. Know the basics, how to clean a wound, what to do for a fever, when to call the doctor versus when to go to the emergency room. Have a reliable source bookmarked. The American Academy of Pediatrics has a symptom checker on their website. The NHS has excellent online guidance. Most pediatric practices have an after-hours nurse line. These are vetted resources that won't hallucinate.
The prompt mentions that every pediatrician has probably dealt with this. What does the pediatrician actually say?
I've been on both sides of this. I was a pediatrician, and I've also been the panicked parent calling the pediatrician. The conversation usually goes, my child ate poop. I don't know, some. They'll be fine. Clean them up, watch for vomiting or diarrhea, call us back if anything changes. It's a 90-second call. The pediatrician is not alarmed because they've had this call 50 times.
The pause is doing a lot of work there.
The pause is the pediatrician calibrating. They're running through the mental checklist, age of child, own stool versus someone else's, volume, underlying health status, and in about 3 seconds they've concluded this is a non-event. But they ask the questions anyway because they've trained themselves not to skip steps.
What about the child who's a repeat offender? The 10-month-old who discovers this fascinating new hobby and goes back for more?
That's a behavioral question more than a medical one. At 10 months, you're not going to reason with them. Prevention is your only tool. That means onesies that fasten in the back, nappy covers that are harder to access, overalls, clothing strategies that keep the hands out. Some parents use backward sleepers. The zip-up pajamas put on backwards so the zipper is in the back and the child can't reach it.
The arms race between infant curiosity and parental ingenuity.
The infant is highly motivated. They found something interesting. It has texture, it has smell, it's warm, it's their own production. From their perspective, this is a fascinating discovery. You're not going to convince them otherwise. You just have to make it physically inaccessible.
Their own production. You found the most clinical possible way to describe it.
I've had decades of practice finding neutral language for things that make parents uncomfortable. It's a skill.
Let's go deeper on the hand sanitizer question, because I think there's a tension here that parents feel but don't always articulate. On the one hand, you want to kill germs. On the other hand, you've absorbed the messaging about the microbiome, about not over-sterilizing your child's environment, about the hygiene hypothesis. How do you balance those?
This is where context matters enormously. The hygiene hypothesis, the idea that reduced early childhood exposure to microorganisms contributes to allergic and autoimmune diseases, is about the routine environment. It's about letting your child play in the dirt, have a pet, encounter the diverse microbial world. It is not about fecal-oral exposure. No version of the hygiene hypothesis suggests that ingesting feces is beneficial. The organisms in stool are not the diverse environmental microbes that help train the immune system. They're gut-adapted organisms that, in the wrong place, cause disease.
The let them eat dirt philosophy doesn't extend to let them eat stool.
Dirt contains soil bacteria, Mycobacterium vaccae, various actinomycetes that are generally harmless and may even be immunomodulatory. Stool contains organisms adapted to colonize and invade the human gut. They're different categories of risk. So when you're cleaning up after a fecal incident, use the antimicrobial. You're not damaging the child's microbiome by sanitizing their hands after they've been in feces. You're preventing infection.
That's a useful bright line. What about the mouth? If you wipe out the mouth after stool ingestion, are you disrupting the oral microbiome?
The oral microbiome lives in a biofilm on the teeth and oral mucosa. A single wipe with a damp cloth isn't going to disrupt it meaningfully. And even if it did, the oral microbiome recolonizes rapidly. It's a resilient ecosystem. The temporary disruption from cleaning is negligible compared to the risk of leaving fecal material in the mouth.
Let me ask you about a scenario the prompt didn't raise, but that I suspect parents worry about. What if you don't catch it immediately? What if the child did this during a nap, and you find the evidence after the fact, and you have no idea how much was ingested or how long ago?
That's a common variant of this scenario. The child wakes up with suspiciously stained hands and face, and you're reconstructing the crime scene. The guidance doesn't change much. You still clean thoroughly. You still monitor. The unknown variables, amount and timing, don't change the management because there's nothing you would do differently based on those variables. You wouldn't pump the stomach, you wouldn't administer activated charcoal, you just clean and watch.
The watchful waiting approach.
Which is the default for most pediatric incidents, honestly. Parents often want to do something active, and the hard part is doing nothing while staying vigilant, but that's often the correct medical approach.
What would make you escalate? What are the red flags that mean stop watching and start driving to the emergency department?
Blood in the stool in the following days. Persistent vomiting, not just spitting up, but forceful vomiting that prevents keeping fluids down. Signs of dehydration, dry mouth, no tears when crying, significantly fewer wet nappies. Lethargy or unusual irritability that's out of proportion to normal fussiness. Fever above 38.5 Celsius in an infant under 3 months, or above 39 in an older infant. And any respiratory distress, rapid breathing, flaring nostrils, sucking in at the ribs.
That's a concrete list people can screenshot.
I want to emphasize, these are for any concerning ingestion, not just stool. The same list applies if your child eats a houseplant, or a handful of dirt, or the cat's food. The body's danger signals are fairly consistent.
Let's talk about the sibling dynamic, because this scenario gets more complicated in multi-child households. The prompt describes a single 10-month-old, but if there's a 3-year-old in the house, the nappy might not be the infant's.
That's a crucial point. Older siblings introduce new variables. If the stool came from a sibling's nappy or potty, it's heterologous, different microbiome, different pathogen profile. A 3-year-old in daycare is a vector for everything. They're bringing home norovirus, rotavirus, hand, foot, and mouth, you name it. If your infant ingests that stool, the risk calculation changes. It's hard to quantify without knowing the sibling's health status and recent exposures, but the risk is meaningfully higher. I'd be more inclined to call the pediatrician proactively rather than just watching and waiting. Not because it's an emergency, but because the pediatrician might want to note it in the chart and give you specific things to watch for based on what's circulating in your area.
The cleanup protocol changes too, I assume. More aggressive disinfection.
For heterologous stool exposure, I'd want full soap and water wash, alcohol-based sanitizer, and attention to every surface the child might have touched. The sibling stool could contain pathogens the infant hasn't encountered. You're not just cleaning up a mess, you're doing infection control.
We've been very clinical. Let me ask the question the prompt is really driving at, which is more emotional. How do parents process this without feeling like they've failed? Because I think the gag reflex is only half the reaction. The other half is, what kind of parent lets this happen?
That's the guilt spiral, and it's completely unwarranted. Infants are fast. They're curious. They're operating on instinct, not judgment. You could be an attentive, loving, vigilant parent, and still have your child reach into their nappy in the 30 seconds you turn to grab a wipe. This is not a parenting failure. It's a developmental stage intersecting with human biology.
The nappy is right there. The hands are right there. The curiosity is innate.
The window of opportunity is constant. Unless you're watching the child every single second, which is neither possible nor healthy, there will be moments when they do something you'd rather they didn't. The measure of parenting isn't preventing every possible incident. It's how you handle the incidents that inevitably occur.
That's the thing to underline. The prompt says ChatGPT coached the parent through a cleaning and sanitization routine, and the story had a happy ending. That parent handled it. They gagged, they panicked, they asked for help, they followed the steps, and the child was fine. That's a success story.
And I'd bet that parent is now much better prepared for the next weird thing their child does, because they've been through one crisis and came out the other side. Parenting is largely about accumulating these experiences and developing the confidence that you can handle them.
The first time is a crisis. The second time is a procedure.
By the third time, you're giving advice to other parents on the playground. That's the arc.
Before we wrap, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about hypochlorous acid. You said it's underappreciated. Where do parents actually find it, and what should they look for on the label?
It's become more available in the last few years. You can find it in pharmacies, online, sometimes in the first aid section of larger stores. Look for hypochlorous acid on the ingredient list. It should be the primary active ingredient, usually at 0.01 to 0.02% concentration. Avoid products that combine it with fragrances or other additives. The whole point is that it's gentle and residue-free. There are brands specifically marketed for baby skin care, for eczema, for eyelid hygiene. The formulation is all essentially the same. It's electrolyzed water and salt, basically. Once opened, about 3 to 6 months. It degrades back into salt water over time, especially if exposed to light. Keep it in a dark bottle in a cool place. If it stops smelling faintly of chlorine, it's probably degraded and you should replace it.
All right, let me try to synthesize what we've covered. A 10-month-old eats a small amount of their own stool. The immediate response is, don't panic more than you're already panicking. Clean the child's hands with soap and water, paying special attention to the fingernails. Wipe out the mouth if there's visible material. Apply alcohol-based hand sanitizer or hypochlorous acid spray once the hands are clean and dry. Do not induce vomiting. Monitor for vomiting, diarrhea, fever, or unusual behavior for 48 hours. Call your pediatrician if any of those appear, or immediately if the stool wasn't the child's own. And then clean yourself and the environment, because secondary transmission is the real threat.
That's the summary. And I'd add, forgive yourself. The disgust and the guilt are normal, but they're not indicators that you've done anything wrong. You're doing fine.
The prompt asks for a real talk about feces and how to keep children safe. I think we've delivered that. It's not appetizing, but it's necessary.
The warning at the top was warranted. I hope nobody listened to this while eating.
If they did, that's on them.
That's on them. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, Portuguese planters on São Tomé and Príncipe cultivated a heritage grain called milho zaburo, a flint maize variety whose kernels contain an unusually high ratio of amylose to amylopectin, making the starch more resistant to digestion and the flour less prone to spoilage in the humid equatorial climate.
There we go. The question we're left with, and I think it's worth sitting with, is whether the anxiety parents feel about incidents like this is proportional to the actual risk, or whether it's amplified by the fact that we don't talk about it. If every parent knew that this happens, and that it's almost always fine, the panic might be a lot less acute.
I think the silence is the problem. Nobody posts on Instagram about their baby eating poop, but it happens. And the more we normalize it, not celebrate it, but acknowledge it as a thing that happens in the course of raising a human, the less power it has to terrify people.
Normalize without celebrating. That's a fine line.
It's the line this whole episode has been walking.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the ship running. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next week with something hopefully less fecal.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.